serious reform in the functioning of the French police have been not successful, and I do not expect that to be successful for more 2-3 decades minimum from now.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in the program. Pleasure to check in with both of you. Mr. Mahmoud Rafat there joining us from Paris, and Mr. Abiyomi Ezekwe joining us from Detroit, Michigan. And viewers, that brings us to the end of the segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim Rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. And when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead, he said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Israeli forces have shot and killed another Palestinian youth during a raid in the occupied West Bank. People have taken to the streets in Burkina Faso to show support for the junta leaders on the anniversary of the military takeover of power in the African country. And in the U.S., thousands more auto workers join an ongoing strike against major car manufacturers over pay and contract issues. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have killed a young Palestinian man and injured another in an attack on the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media said regime forces ambushed the young men and opened fire at their vehicle near the city of Al Bira. One of the victims, identified as Mohammed Romane, succumbed to his injuries after the attack. The Hamas resistance movement says Romane and his companion were its members. This said in a statement that he was a hero and was killed trying to defend the freedom of Palestinians. Israel has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in recent months and has killed over 200 people, including children, in the West Bank this year. A Ramallah correspondent, Monica Ndil, told us more about the latest Israeli brutality in the occupied West Bank.
The military declared that two Palestinians arrived at the entrance to the illegal settlement of Pesagot, built on the lands of Al Biri adjacent to Ramallah, and that they threw Molotov cocktails at the Israeli military checkpoint there, and thus the Israeli forces opened fire, killing one and wounding the other. Mohammed Jibril Mani, 18 years old, was shot and killed. His friend was wounded, and both were arrested. The body of Mohammed, of course, was confiscated by the Israeli forces, and the military declared that he succumbed to his injuries. Hamas movement issued a statement later saying that Mohammed was one of its members, and he supports Hamas, and he was killed while defending the Palestinian lands and trying to face the Israeli forces' brutality.
After 58 days of a hunger strike, a Palestinian held in Israeli jails, is facing an increased and imminent risk to his health. That's according to a local NGO, the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Kayet Fasfous has been relocated from Ascalon prison to the notorious Ramla prison clinic due to a severe health setback. The 34-year-old is on a hunger strike to protest his indefinite detention without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. This marks his second imprisonment, having previously spent nearly 7 years in Israeli jails. There are nearly 5,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, including 160 children. Some 1,200 of them are administrative detainees. The UN chief has called on Israel to release the administrative detainees or to bring charges against them, if any exist. A demonstration against the illegal arrest and detention of a Palestinian-Italian researcher by Israel has been held at Rome's largest university, La Sapienza. There, hundreds of students called on the government to act immediately to secure the researcher's release. Max Civilli has more.
Khaled Al-Kaisi is a Palestinian-Italian researcher and student of the Department of Oriental Languages and Civilizations at the Sapienza University of Rome. On August 31st, he was returning from a trip to Bethlehem with his wife and four-year-old child when the Israeli occupation forces arrested him at a checkpoint on the Jordanian border. Al-Kaisi has been detained without any formal charges since that day. On Thursday, hundreds of students from Sapienza University staged a demonstration against Israel's unlawful practice of detaining Palestinians indefinitely without charge or trial and Italy's inaction over the detention of Al-Kaisi.
Administrative detention by Israel must stop once and for all. Al-Kaisi risks being held in prison indefinitely if the Italian government doesn't take a firm position on the issue.
Al-Kaisi is currently being held at the Petah Tikva Interrogation Center that is notorious for torture and inhuman treatment. His detention has been extended to October the 1st over, quote, national security concerns. Some members of the Italian parliament have tabled a parliamentary inquiry on the illegal arrest and detention of Al-Kaisi by Israeli occupation forces. However, the Italian government has so far done nothing or very little to protect the rights of an Italian citizen unlawfully seized in front of his family.
I don't know for sure if there is a connection between Italy's government and the media, if our media are subjected to some form of pressure by the government. What I know is that the executive seems to be more interested in protecting its political interest rather than one of its citizens.
A latest report by the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East has found that 1,264 Palestinians are currently held in administrative detention by Israel. The number, according to the UN envoy, is the highest in over a decade. Max Civilli, Rome.
Iran's president says the West has long feared the emergence of a rival civilization in the country that is capable of offering a different worldview to contemporary humanity. Raisi said the real basis for the Iranophobia and Islamophobia campaigns in the West is Muslims' strong background in all scientific fields. He added that the West has failed to prevent the emergence of a modern Islamic civilization, especially in Iran. Raisi made the remarks during an address to the 5th Mustafa Prize ceremony. That is a science and technology award granted to top researchers and scientists from the Muslim world. It has been held since 2015 biennially, and this year's ceremony is held in the Iranian city of Isfahan. Hundreds of people have rallied in Burkina Faso's capital in a show of support for the ruling military leaders.
On this day, September 29, 2023, we have come out here to the Place de la Révolution to show our compassion and encouragement to our authorities and to urge them to move towards a new constitution that will reflect our aspirations. Because we know that the article of the constitution, we inherited it from France, which is our colonizer, which is imperialist. So today, we want a constitution adapted to our realities.
The protesters waved national flags and held signs in support of the country's young military leader, Captain Ibrahim Traoré. He took power on September 30th last year, after ousting the leader of another coup who had seized power 8 months prior. Traoré has gained popularity through his anti-French speeches. He has also kicked out French troops and restricted French media amid tensions between France and the former colony, Burkina Faso. Pilots of Canada's biggest airliner have staged a protest in the city of Toronto to demand better pay and benefits as talks over a new contract continues. The Air Canada pilots are pressing for higher wages and better scheduling. Currently, their union is engaged in negotiations with Air Canada, and it anticipates that these discussions will persist throughout October. The company's previous decade-long contract ends on Friday. The new contract would cover 4,500 pilots. The protests come after U.S. pilots working for several airlines achieved historic gains in new labor deals over the past few months. Meanwhile, in the U.S., thousands more auto workers have joined the ongoing strike against the country's three major car manufacturers over pay and other issues. The biggest U.S. automobile workers union says that walkouts now leave a total of some 25,000 workers on strike in 21 states. The latest union members who joined the industrial action are at two plants in Chicago and Michigan. This is the first ever joint strike at Ford, GM, and Stellantis, known as the Big Three Detroit automakers. The union says sufficient progress has not been made in talks. It has asked for a 40% pay raise over the next four-year contract, while the companies have been offering just 20%. Hundreds of thousands of workers in various sectors have walked off their jobs this year, ranging from Hollywood scriptwriters and actors to nurses, hotel staff, and pilots. Income inequality amid soaring prices has been cited as the main reason. Meanwhile, the U.S. is inching closer to a government shutdown after the Republican-led House fails to approve a bill to temporarily fund the government. More than a dozen Republicans have voted against the party's own stopgap bill proposed by their leader, Kevin McCarthy. They joined all Democrats that also opposed the measure due to deep cuts to the government programs. The Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has warned that a likely closure would undermine the country's economic progress. The government will shut down on Sunday if no agreement is reached. It will trigger the furlough of hundreds of thousands of federal workers and would halt a wide range of government services. It would also leave troops without pay. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. Millions of Britons have been hit hard by levels of inflation not seen in decades. That has been blamed on a number of reasons, including the war in Ukraine, COVID, Brexit, and the government's economic policies. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affect health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe. And it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the group of seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
The British economy is expected to shrink this year and in the year 2024. That's according to a study by Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics. It says that persistent inflation and a shortage of workers, among other things, will result in a 0.3% drop in the UK's gross domestic product this year.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecasts predict, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
And that does it for World News. Just bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Unity and new Islamic civilization. A few decades after the emergence of Islam, the Islamic civilization started thriving in the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. The Islamic civilization was the torchbearer of science and culture for several centuries. This civilization blossomed in a very uncivilized and uncultured region of the world, while the adjacent civilizations too were in decline. To put it more clearly, the ancient Iran, Rome, and Greece were going through very bleak and decadent juncture. Muslims, inspired by the teachings of the Prophet, and following his behavior and practice, established the foundations of a civilization and culture which became the luminous beacon for all seekers of knowledge and lofty human merits. It set the ground for the growth of engineers, chemists, physicists, philosophers, physicians, astronomers, geologists, mathematicians, geographers, lawyers, and many other scientists who played significant roles in flourishing of human culture in every field. The expansion of scientific disciplines and morality, importance of thinking, dominance of the spirit of solidarity and collectivity over egotism, profiteering and totalitarianism, blend of labor and faith were among the outstanding features of the Islamic civilization for several centuries. It can be said that a very prominent feature of the Islamic civilization is the fact that it never attaches itself to a particular race, a particular ethnicity or language. Therefore, various ethnicities such as Arabs, Turks, Indians, Chinese, Africans, Mongols and Persians had all a share and enjoyed the thriving of the Islamic civilization. However, for sure, ethics and spirituality had a very determining status in the Islamic civilization. As in the contemporary era, the Islamic Revolution in Iran took place with the same features, and it has been considered as the most important revolution of not just the 20th century, but the second millennium. Naturally, a revolution that is based on the Islamic and Quranic values will try to revive the past glorious civilization in the modern era. The zenith of the ideal of the Islamic Revolution is to build the new Islamic civilization on the basis of Imam Mahdi's government. In view of this, unity among all Muslims is a very important factor. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Unity of the Islamic world has levels. The lowest level is that the Islamic communities, Islamic countries and Islamic governments and Islamic ethnicities, Islamic sects do not embark on conflict and do not clash with one another, do not deal a blow to one another. This is the first step. Of course, higher than this is that the Islamic world, besides avoiding dealing blows to each other, become hand in hand against a common enemy, have true and sufficient unity and defend one another. This is also an upper step. Higher than this is that the Islamic countries, Islamic nations make synergy. Islamic countries are not at the same level in terms of sciences, wealth, security and political power. They can help one another and make synergy. Those who are higher in any section take the hand of those who are lower. This is another phase of unity. The higher phase is that the whole Islamic world gets united for reaching the new Islamic civilization. This is what the Islamic Republic of Iran has considered as its ultimate goal, reaching the Islamic civilization. Yet a civilization proportionate with the age, the new Islamic civilization. These are the levels of unity." The Islamic civilization can be likened to a construction that, if it is to be built properly and beautifully, it requires coordination and thinking together of engineers and experts. Thus, the formation of the new Islamic civilization requires unity and convergence of Muslim thinkers and scientists. It is in exigent need of struggles of all Muslims, hope in the divine assistance, God-wariness, insight, vigilance, refraining from backwardness and small-mindedness, spread of ethics, scrutiny of all human sciences and achievements, serious shunning of absorption and digestion by Western culture. The Islamic civilization is quite opposite to the Western civilization. Progress in the Western civilization is accumulation of wealth and advancement in science, technology, and military matters. But progress in Islam has much more dimensions and includes ethics, justice, public welfare, dignity, international credit, political sovereignty and independence, all of which are tools for reaching servitude of Allah and attaining His proximity. Therefore, the Islamic civilization seeks both material and spiritual progress. The pioneers of the Islamic unity believe that coherence and comprehension around common ideological and intellectual axes will provide the ground for materialization of this aspiration of mankind. For instance, faith in Allah, the Holy Prophet, the Holy Quran, love of the Holy Prophet's household or the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, a single Qibla, the Hajj pilgrimage, hijab, and so on, are commonalities of all Muslims. Moreover, the existence of common enemies and challenges are fundamental factors which can help to unite all Muslims. Positive dialogue, closeness of thought, refraining from insulting each other's sanctities, not engaging in rumour-mongering, hypocrisy and hostility, seeking the truth, shunning obstinacy, moving from slogan towards practice are other factors which can cement unity among Islamic communities. Participation in each other's religious ceremonies and gatherings like Friday prayers and the Hajj pilgrimage will also bolster unity. We all know that Muslims enjoy common and similar rituals for marriage, divorce, business, world outlook, etc. In the course of building up of the Islamic civilization, we should permanently monitor the plots of the enemies and stand against them with insight, steadfastness and courage. We must never allow the hypocrites to infiltrate the ranks of Muslims. Muslims should do their best to gain their lost position as the reference of sciences and technologies in the world. This will materialize for sure, God willing, inshallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Colonization of the Mind with David Miller.
Part 2.
In all the years since the revolution in 1979, Iran has been limited, sanctioned, and under pressure. As a result, much like Russia under Putin, Iran has pushed towards self-sufficiency and has prioritized technological developments.
We're in a period where Iranian military technology is becoming a serious force in the world, and that, you know, didn't happen overnight. I mean, as I've walked around this museum, you know, one of the key things you see is the lack of technology at the beginning of the war, the poor equipment of many of the soldiers. And as the war goes on, you see the development of the technology. The sanctions cause the development. I mean, it's just like with Russia. You know, the idea that we could, a year ago, sanction Russia and that would lead to the collapse of the Russian economy, a coup against Putin and the dissolution of the Russian Federation. That was clearly a monstrous miscalculation on behalf of NATO. But of course, it's a monstrous miscalculation because Russia is now a country which is self-sufficient in most things. And the sanctions are the mother of invention, of development, of the economy, but also of military technology. And when you have to develop, rise on the world stage in a way which is probably nobody expected outside Iran 2 or 3 years ago.
We have people in Iran, especially among the elites, the wealthy, the upper middle class, the middle class, that as the United States is strangling us, they will say Russia is the enemy. as the United States is cutting our throats, they'll say China is the enemy, because they'll mimic what they are, you know, what is what the dominant narrative in the West says.
Isn't there a Farsi word for this?
It's Ali Ahmad.
Yeah,
Jalal Ali Ahmad. He wrote a small book, which influenced me a lot.
Yeah.
And I sometimes in my classes I teach Ali Ahmad. Not in all my classes, but sometimes I do teach his work. But that I think is true about the elites in Europe, that they are so bound to the United States that many of them are willing to sacrifice. I mean, the foreign minister of Germany, for example, I think she once said that it doesn't matter what the popular opinion is, we have to, you know, we're going to support Ukraine.
But if I give the promise to people in Ukraine, we stand with you as long as you need us, then I want to deliver, no matter what my German voters think, but I want to deliver to the people of Ukraine.
Why? Because the United States, I mean, the Green Party, you would imagine, would be the most anti-war party on the political spectrum. And it was once upon a time. But it is now the most pro-war party. So I think it's similar to what we have in Iran. In Iran, we have people who have this, you know, as they're being strangled, they'll say, the other guy is the enemy. And I think that among elites in Europe and the United States, it's the same, because we're all trained to understand the world in a certain way. In Iran, for example, if you go right across the University of Tehran to the right across the main campus, if you go to any of the bookshops, all of the books that we study, almost all of them, or are translations of English texts, many of them. So our understanding of humanity, our understanding about ourselves, our understanding about our own religion, our own history, is deeply impacted by Western narratives.
Yeah.
So it sounds crazy, especially to see Germany being destroyed the way it is. But they'll go down with the ship, apparently.
I was very pleased to see Professor Morandi. I've followed his work for some time. I've been in touch with him, as you can see from the discussion there. And he, you know, he's a serious public intellectual, which people in the West do know about, but so he's not. He doesn't have nearly the reputation that he should have as a result of the way in which knowledge works in the West. You know, that the people with the best knowledge aren't the people who necessarily get the best hearing in the West. So it was very good to meet him in person and to hear some of his thoughts.
Over the decades, anti-Iranian movements have changed in strategies and solutions. Nowadays, they are more complex and directed by intelligence agencies in the UK, US and Israel, amongst others. The strategies are implemented both inside and outside Iran.
What has interested you with regard to Iran?
Well, I mean, the things I talked about today were about the role of Western intelligence agencies. I started off with the execution of the alleged British spy, whose confession had apparently included the mention that there was some. He had been involved in some discussion with his handlers about the Iranian nuclear scientist who was then assassinated. It was thought by Mossad. So, which suggests, if it's true, we don't know, that MI6 were involved in some way in the assassination. Wouldn't be surprising. I mean, they regularly collaborate with Mossad, even at the same time. So the CIA, even at the same time as Mossad, is actually spying on them and running ops against them, you know, and that's a kind of interesting thing we've kind of come across in the programme. So there's that, and then there's the way in which MI6 runs a whole load of, what should we call them, assets, cutouts, NGOs, media operations, many, many more than people in the UK anyhow realise or recognise, and the effect of that can be quite dramatic in terms of public and official conceptions of what a problem is.
The cyber attack, the terror attack, the sabotage attacks, they happen by Mossad. Because the CIA network in Iran has been dismantled, admittedly, of course, three times in the past 13 to 15 years, especially in the last 13 years. Now, I remember quite well that the U.S. media were blaming CIA last year that they have left all their informants in here, in Iran, without any kind of protection or assistance. They have left them all together.
It's one of the things that's interesting to me is that we see in the last 15 years, maybe even less than that, a new strategy from America, from the CIA, which it seems to be called a small media strategy, whereby the CIA pumps money into front groups, into small citizen journalism startups, small websites, into media defense and media freedom and free speech organizations, the purpose of which is to subvert the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, many of these organizations happen to be based in London. And the question is how this works. Well, in historical times, the CIA used to send money directly to organizations like the very famous Congress for Cultural Freedom. But that phase of American subversion came to an end when the Congress for Cultural Freedom was exposed as a CIA front. And today they have this new small media strategy where the money doesn't come direct from the CIA, it comes indirectly. And first of all, it comes through the National Endowment for Democracy, an organization which even its head has described as the new way for the CIA to pass money to its assets in other countries, because it's more of a camouflage for their activities. And the NED funds many of these organizations that are active in Iran, but it also sends money, the Americans also send money through sympathetic European governments, especially Scandinavian governments, and they send money through sympathetic foundations which were used by the CIA back in the 1960s in the US, like the Smith Richardson Foundation, but also it seems through foundations in the UK which are now involved in funding organizations as part of this small media strategy. And indeed, there's even an organization in London called the Small Media Foundation. And essentially, this is a way of the CIA passing money through intermediaries to get to its assets, which are including which are in the UK. Many of them are in the UK. And Small Media, for example, has funded a whole range of organizations.
So they arrange everything. Their strategists work on this formula. They do the coordinations. They do the soft part, like the media, the cognitive warfare, media warfare. But the hard parts are done by the Mossad. And there has been a tit-for-tat according to the Israelis again. Like Iran's top nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, when he was assassinated 5-6 months later, the U.S. media, the Israeli media, Times of Israel, said that in the city of Acre, which has been very, very peaceful, suddenly hundreds of youth took out to the streets, started protesting, like the things that are happening here. And then they moved towards the hotel, they went upstairs, they found the father of Israel's aerospace program, Avi Hariven. They killed him with 100 staffs or something like that. And then they came down and set fire on the entire hotel. They were forced to acknowledge that because at first they were saying that people were asking, where is Avi Hariven? And they said, okay, the guy has had an accident. He's in a coma for 3-4 months. But later, when some videos surfaced in YouTube showing that the hotel is on fire and some other things, they were forced to acknowledge and that they were complaining. I mean, Times of Israel was complaining
why did we kill Fakhrizadeh in such theatrical ways? Why? This is, you know, they could have killed him just with one single bullet, yeah. But they've given him 100 stabs. What they didn't know is that when your Netanyahu says that we are going to kill Iran with this kind of strategy, 1,000 stabs, 1,000 scars, okay, these are 100. Let alone, you will receive 900 more later.
Well, I mean, look, what's happening is that it's like Palestine. There will be a continual process of hybrid warfare until or unless it can be forced to stop. And the only sign I can see that it can be forced to stop is the tectonic plates of multipolarity. I mean, you know, what's happened in the last year, disaster of the sanctions against Russia, the stepping up of the Chinese on the world stage, the expansion of the BRICS, the Shanghai Development Organization, the alliance or the rapprochement with the Saudis announced just the other day. These are all movements which will have a serious deleterious effect on the ability of the US to wage hybrid warfare. And we're also seeing, aren't we, economic changes which might limit the freedom of action which the US has.
Well, I mean, the BBC have always been hostile to progressive forces in Iran and anti-colonial forces. I mean, they remain so. The BBC Persian service is funded directly by the Foreign Office. I mean, I think maybe what's interesting is to say that, you know, it was the British who wanted to organise a coup here, but they couldn't get the CIA on board. They realised they needed the CIA. British power was waning. And it was only when they got the CIA on board that the coup was launched. As I said in my talk the other day, the coup was launched by an announcement on the BBC Persian service at midnight, where they changed the wording that they usually had, and that was the signal for the coup to start. So the BBC was directly involved in the coup. But then we have a period now where the Israelis have been trying to encourage an attack on Iran for many years. And of course, they have been directly attacking Iran, doing assassinations, sponsoring Kurdish proxies, and many other things. But they have a number of think tanks in the US, which are effectively Israeli state assets, who have been trying to encourage an attack on Iran. But the CIA is not ready for that. So they've got an organization called the United Against Nuclear Iran, which has a former director of Mossad on its board, and which works closely with Iranian opposition figures, for example, Masih Alinejad, who works directly for the US. So there is an anti-Iran lobby. The Israelis wanted to go further and faster. The Americans are directors of the campaign against Iran, and they have stopped so short so far of a direct invasion, because they calculate, I would guess, that they wouldn't get very far. And so we see a period now where, with the rise of multipolarity, with the catastrophic decision of NATO to attack Russia in the Ukraine conflict, and the rise in the status of Iran as a power in the world, we see that the game is afoot. We don't know what's going to happen. It doesn't look likely that a direct attack on Iran can now come, but they will certainly do everything they can to try and constrain Iran. The sanctions, the meddling with the currency, the use of bullying of other nations so that they don't trade with Iran, all of these are mechanisms to try and defeat the Iranian people.
It's true, because the world power is shifting from the West to the East. Yep. Admittedly, and what we are experiencing, I believe, is a decade of the US-led West's resistance and opposition, strong opposition, against this transition of power, yeah, to the East. So that's why we are seeing tumultuous era in with regard to Russia, China, Iran. It's happening, actually, all, I believe, it's orchestrated
by the U.S. hegemonic rule, U.S.-led West,
yeah.
Especially the three European states, France, U.K., as well as Germany, especially the United States. So they are not going to let it happen so easily.
No.
They are resistant against it. I believe they will eventually push China into some kind of war with Taiwan also. Although the Chinese are so much conservatives,
they're going to lose that war, aren't they? I mean, you know, the Chinese will hop, skip, and jump into Taiwan.
Yeah, they could do that easily. And now the same thing that happened to Ukraine is happening to Taiwan. I mean, yeah. They leave you no other choice. If you don't take action, you're a loser. If you take action, you go into war, you're a loser.
Sure.
So that's what the Americans have been doing, starting proxy warfare everywhere. And this rapprochement with Saudi Arabia is important so much because of exactly the same thing with regard to Iran. And when it comes to a coalition of the U.S., the Israeli-Saudi alliance and front against Iran, the Saudis apparently have realized that the U.S. cannot do more for them. They have left the Afghan government.
But they'd already left, haven't they, when they reoriented towards Russia several months ago. And now Iran, I mean, that's a really catastrophic sign for the U.S., isn't it?
So what I see is a decade of tumults and wars and, you know, change of coalitions and groupings in the world.
The record of victories in the last decade, they failed in Afghanistan, they failed in Syria, they won in Syria and in Libya, but where else have they had success? I mean, really, virtually nowhere else. Yeah. It's not going well for them. They didn't even win in Venezuela.
And I believe, before anyone else, these are the European people, nations, that will pay the price.
That's right. It's a direct attack on Europe.
It's of much regret. And they are already.
Yeah. I mean,
they are already paying that, the rising cost of living.
Yeah.
That's regrettable.
And the sooner the Europeans realize that they're being attacked by the Americans, their ally, and do something about it, then the better the whole world will be.
And do you see any chance that the EU would fall down, you know, would collapse?
I don't think it's impossible. I think we're a long way from it, but I don't think it's impossible. I mean, things are changing so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, you sit there waiting for it to change, and you think it can go faster, and it doesn't go faster. But then all of a sudden something happens, and you're like, whoa, we've moved much faster than I thought, you know? So it doesn't come in a smooth way.
The world is changing fast. All that has seemed frozen for a generation begins to melt. Common sense political opinions are swept away. Maybe we will be shocked and amazed by coming events. But it seems to me that Iran, with its 3,000 years of civilization, is beginning to play a globally significant role, beating back the subversion and violence directed from abroad.
So this is my last night in Tehran. I've been here, I think, four nights now. And we're stuck in traffic again. It's Nowruz in a couple of days. That's really a New Year. And everyone's out buying stuff to prepare for that. So the traffic's even worse than normal. And I suppose that, you know, one of the things I've learned since I've been here is the variety of ways in which Iranian society operates, the different parts of Tehran, the different elements in the society, the Western influences, the Islamic influences, the cultural influences from the past, all mixed up together here in you know, kind of extraordinary melange in Tehran. And I suppose what the thing I've also learned is about some differences between Iran and the UK, which I don't know if I appreciated before. In particular, I've seen the way in which commemorations are organised here are very different from in the UK. The way in which the police operate appears to be very different from in the UK. The way in which there are public displays of the history and the politics of this country. So, for example, of the 1953 coup, of the 1979 revolution, all over the place, the portraits of Haj Qasem Soleimani all around Tehran, and the commemoration of his assassination by the Americans, and, you know, as we saw at the British Embassy potentially also British involvement in that. And those displays that one sees, the politics displays, are very, very different to the displays that you see in the UK. There's nothing like the kind of the expression of a revolutionary approach to life that there is here, and that's instructive. And you see that in the different ways in which people react and respond. Of course, here there are a variety of different views on things. We've seen that in many, many occasions as we've gone through the city and, for example. And it's you know, it's really salutary to be reminded that a small country like Iran, it's not small in terms of population, but small in terms of how it's seen in the Western world, which is clearly in the geopolitics of today becoming a country which has a much higher status in the world. As the geopolitics changes, as we move towards multipolarity, Iran becomes a country which not only is an important part of the move to multipolarity, but which has its own significant contribution to make to multipolarity. All of these are signs that Iran is starting to play a role in the world which it simply didn't do 30 years ago. I'm very much looking forward to coming back here on another occasion. And I hope that people who watch this documentary can see some of the lessons that I've learned as I've been here and maybe start to understand a bit more from outside Iran what Iran is like in reality. A complex, contradictory place, yes, but nothing like what is shown in the Western media, nothing at all like what is shown in the Western media, and indeed nothing at all like the perspectives on it by the Western left, who continue to see Iran as a backward place, ridden with religion, and not a place which has any role to play in progressive forces in the world, which I think is a mistaken and factually incorrect position given everything I've seen here in the last few days. So, I urge people who can to come and visit Iran, because you'll see it's not what they think.
Limelight. Chicago has sued Monsanto Corporation for widespread contamination of the Chicago River. A Chicago lawyer has said records show that Monsanto intentionally misled the American public. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote, Chicago is suing the Monsanto Corporation for producing cancer-causing polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. The complaint filed in Cook County Court recently alleges that the company caused widespread contamination across the banks and sediment of the Chicago River, which the city continues to bear the cost of cleanup. The Monsanto Corporation was the sole producer of PCBs, which were used in electrical equipment and other industrial applications in the United States from 1930s through 1977. While the U.S. banned the production of PCBs more than 40 years ago because the chemicals are harmful to human and environmental health, PCBs continue to be released into the Chicago waterways through storm water. For decades, Monsanto knew that its commercial PCB formulations were highly toxic and would inevitably produce precisely the contamination and human health risks that have occurred. Yet Monsanto intentionally misled the public, the complaint said.
PCBs are linked to a number of potential health threats, including cancer. And studies have shown that pregnant women who have consumed fish contaminated with PCBs have given birth to children with neurological damage. The lawsuit says the accumulation of PCBs in natural resources and fish in particular poses a public health threat to Chicago residents. As a result of the contamination, Chicago is being required by the Environmental Protection Agency to reduce PCB contamination in stormwater that is discharged to Lake Michigan by an estimated 99.6%. The lawsuit added, "These violations by Monsanto have caused and will cause the city to incur costs reasonably related to those violations of law. These costs include the cost of cleaning up contaminated sites and reducing PCB concentrations in the city's stormwater. Chicago is following the lead of other cities and states that have used Monsanto, alleging that Monsanto knew of the environmental and health risks of the chemical before they were officially banned." According to a memo published by the Poison Papers Project, the company was aware of the health and environmental problems posed